If you're a custodial supervisor at a local high school, you know that cleanliness is key and that the best place to get cleaning supplies is from Grainger. Grainger helps you stay fully stocked on the products you trust, from paper towels and disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Plus, you can rely on Grainger for easy reordering, so you never run out of what you need. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, welcome back, everybody, to another year of the Sunday Podcast.
I'm Ollie Lum.
And I'm Matt Seddon.
Back in 2025 for our fifth season. You can expect more of this.
He's claiming that he was ill before the semifinal, whatever. But, you know, I just feel like at that point he was just looking for attention.
And some of this.
You normally say no human is limited. So I can't limit myself, or I can't just say I can do.
As well as event coverage around all the major races on the UK circuit.
And if you're a fan of the pod, please give us a rating and review on your preferred podcast streaming service.
And if you want to stay up to date with all the latest news, give us a follow on Instagram at Sunday Podcast.
As always, thanks for listening. See you next time. And we hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello and welcome back to another episode. As always, this one is brought to you by sportshoes.com. Hugh Brayshaw on the podcast today. So whilst track season is in full swing, the Tokyo World Champs just around the corner, hopefully today gets you in the mood for a bit of road racing action. Obviously, we've got the Great North Run and the London Big Half coming up next weekend as well. Matt sat down with Hugh Brayshaw to talk all things London Marathon. The CEO himself talking through that historic race over the years. Yeah, Matt and I will be back with a bonus episode midweek for you guys and to talk through that British team that is going to Tokyo and preview the champs itself as well. So loads of track stuff coming up. But today, it's all about the roads. Enjoy this one with you. Catch you very soon.
Okay, Hugh, welcome to the podcast. Pleasure to have you on today. Race director and CEO of the London Marathon. And your father, obviously, Chris Brayshaw, co-founder of the event, started it all in 1981. Did you have any involvement in day one? Do you remember it?
I do remember it. I sold 6,300 train tickets at the bottom of the Strand Palace Hotel in the cloakroom to every runner that was taking part. So in those days, you didn't get free train travel. You had to buy a train ticket and you bought it off me for 50 pence. And wow. I was a 15-year-old, so you can work out my age. Was I 16? No, maybe I was 16. And it was Easter holidays. And that was my job for 3 days.
Wow. And was that your job over the years as well? When did you promote from selling train tickets?
No, that was basically, I worked at a retailer called Sweatshop. So I worked on Saturdays and I worked in school holidays. Had one shop. It was my father's store and it was a specialist running shop. It was sort of called a mixture of Christopher Brayshaw's Sporting Emporium and Sweatshop. A dreadful name, Christopher Brayshaw's Sporting Emporium. I always remember he came home one evening, very proud of himself, saying he's got five new names for the shop and as a family, we should vote on them. So the family voted on them and the resounding last choice was Christopher Brayshaw's Sporting Emporium. And my father generally didn't listen to people anyway. So in true fashion, he decided that that was the best name. So anyway, I used to take kit to school to sell. So the shop at that stage sold football boots, tennis rackets. I used to take these decent tennis rackets, because I was a tennis player actually, or football boots to school and sell them, and worked in the store. So I think the second year, 1982, at that stage I was working at Sweatshop and sold a load of kit to the runners, which I did for most years. I didn't actually join London Marathon events until 2010. So by that stage, though, I'd built Sweatshop up to 43 specialist running stores. We were the largest specialist running retailer in the country. We had the world's first physiology lab, if you are interested in physiology, so am I. And the world's first retail physiology lab. We used to take blood from your earlobe while you were on a treadmill, measure the oxygen in your blood going from aerobic to anaerobic training, and then write a training program. Had a brilliant phlebotomist and sports physiologist called Joe Dunbar, who was a decent runner himself, and it got called the Nike Lab. And we did it. We ended up sort of selling the idea to Nike, and that was sort of 1997. So it really was very much looking at, and sport should be, and I would still say it's pretty advanced for retail and actually physiology now,
way ahead of its time. That doesn't really exist anymore in shoe shops.
It doesn't exist. I mean, you know, then this was 1997. We had a world's first meter long force plate in the store. So we really were at the cutting edge of retail. In a way, you get super shoes these days. Mm. We were looking at the force going through your foot, how you could try and ensure, really, with the Nike Lab, it was about enabling people to train to the best of their ability with the time that they had. So very few of us can be the best in the world, but we can all be the best that we can possibly be. And that best is about how much effort you want to put in. It's about how much time that you want to put in. It's your decision on the effort. It's your decision on the time. So we would give the advice scientifically on the best way to train in that time that you could possibly give. And I would say in society that probably hasn't changed. Time is one of the most valuable commodities that we actually have. And therefore maximizing your use of that time and doing that scientifically in training was what we were looking at. And yeah, that's 28 years ago.
Was that lab successful back then? Because I feel like now it would be extremely successful. You'd have queues out the door if that was being offered at a shoe store.
The shop was enormously successful. I mean, Sweatshop was groundbreaking in what we did, the customer service, teaching staff basic biomechanics. We had a host of, actually great runners. Mo Farah. Mm. So Mo Farah worked there. He worked in our warehouse and then he was sort of one of the Saturday staff. So we had loads of athletes. When I started working there in 1982, full time, the manager of the store was a guy called Grenville Tuck, one of the Tuck twins. And Grenville was a 28, 10-minute 10K runner. Most incredible man. He's and just give everyone the time of day and give them advice and be winning races, and then there he would be serving you if you were just the person who just decided to start running. This is the early 80s. I mean, the London Marathon in those days was it's the first event was 6,500 people, 6,300 finishers. And I remember, the third event, I think, was 1983, was the first year I did it. And I queued up to post my entry form in a post box. All the post boxes, my father and John Disley, who, they were the co-founders, they got the post office to open about, 256 different post boxes around the UK at 7 in the morning. And you were allowed 6 entries and each entry got time stamped. And so they picked the first entries from all the different post boxes around the country. And I remember I was there with one of my colleagues, a guy called Adrian Webb, who's actually a coach now. And he started queuing. We left work, I think it was at 5:30. So he got to Kingston post office at 6 and he started queuing at 6. And I went home and I took over from him at something like 12:30, so half past midnight. And when he started queuing at 6, we were something like 47th in the queue. And at half past midnight, they would walked around the queue. I think it was 253 people in the queue. These days it's a lottery. In those days, you earned your place.
So even though the participation numbers were less, there was still huge demand.
Yeah, absolutely. There was huge demand. It was, I think that was something that even surprised them, the level of demand. I think that that first one, you know, no one really knew what would happen. You know, my father and John had you know, famously been to New York in 1979, in the New York City Marathon, and felt and experienced something that they thought was so unique that it needed to be in London. But they didn't know at those days, you know, marathon running was done by just men, and they were club runners, and the only people watching was the odd cow or sheep, because they were done in country lanes. And all of a sudden, this was going to be done in city centres, and they didn't know. And I have to say, you know, that first, people say, oh, what do you remember about the first London Marathon? And my answer is nothing, because I was asleep. You know, I'd worked for 3 days, and I was 16, and I was exhausted. And it actually wasn't until Monday when I woke up and went downstairs. And my father in those days used to get the Times and the Daily Mail, and the Daily Mail had the front page of Dick Beardsley and Ingrid Simonson hand in hand on crossing the finish line. And it was only then that I understood that they had really created something quite incredible.
Well, they truly have. And perhaps a loaded question for you now, but it's the largest marathon in the world. You surpassed New York, which is where it all started, as you said, and over 1 million people now entering that ballot, two times the amount I was looking back. Even in 2019, I think, was it 450,000 entered the ballot. So pre the pandemic. I mean, it's just incredible growth. And what do you put that down to? Is it a bit of luck with the running boom, or have you guys had some strategic movements that have resulted in this?
Look, I think it is really about focusing on giving people the most incredible experience possible. And it is very difficult to describe to somebody the emotions and the feelings they will go through on that day. And they are pretty profound emotions and feelings. And it genuinely will be one of the greatest days of your life, because running a marathon is hard. Running 26.2 miles is difficult. And you will go through bad patches. And some total stranger will invariably reach out to you and either offer you some words of comfort, offer you a drink, offer you some nutrition. Whatever they will do, they will reach out to you. And you in turn will reach out at some stage to a total stranger and do the same for them. And we don't do that in society. That is not the way that we seem to have been brought up, wrongly, or we might have been brought up that way rightly, but then something has happened on the way that has changed that opinion. And yet on that day, not only will you be reaching out to strangers and helping them and vice versa, but you will have close to 1 million people cheering your name. So put your name on your vest, cheering you on that incredible journey from Blackheath to the Mall. And they will genuinely want you to be successful. And in life, there is very few times that people genuinely want you to be successful. You know, you might have a few friends who really, really want you to be successful. And if you do, you're incredibly lucky. But on that day, you'll get tens of thousands of people who just know that you're on this journey, and that they know that your support is, that their support is going to help you. And it is just the most incredibly positive experience, whether you're in the crowd willing these people on this mad journey of 26.2 miles, or, you know, and people, some are running at the absolute elite end, some are running for PBs, but 3/4 of the field are running for charity to remember somebody, to over 1.45 billion pounds has been raised by the runners since 1981, which is just quite staggering and incredible. So I think that it is really what we try and do as an events company is we try and make sure that we offer the best possible experience that we can, and to make that experience as individual as we can for the person. And so one of the sort of sayings that we've got and how we look to the future is, how can you make an incredible individual experience for each person in a mass participation world? How can you break it down? How can you try and make sure that you do that? And it is incredibly difficult, as each change that we make has, you know, an impact somewhere. You know, often people say, oh, fail quickly. Well, you can't really fail quickly in a marathon because it only is happening once a year. And it's a marathon. So it can be quite frustrating because, you know, it's like a super tanker. You do one little thing and eventually somewhere, you know, something happens, but sometimes there's an unintended consequence. And, you know, we really try and make sure that we've got an amazing event for the greatest athletes in the world, for championship athletes, for good for age athletes, for charity athletes, for international athletes. And each time when we do the debrief, we look and we go, okay, this could be better and that can be better. So it really is it's a team of people who are really intent on trying to deliver their element of the event to the highest possible caliber and really understand what the customer wants and what they're going through and make sure that they surpass that.
Yeah, you honestly tick all the boxes for those competing. Were there record numbers on the streets this year as well? Obviously, participation is through the roof. Record fans out on the course?
Yeah, I mean, again, this
hard
is going
to quantify.
Well, I'm a bit of a data freak, and every runner brings on average 5.4 people, and every person travels on average to 2.2 locations. Obviously, you can't bring 0.4 of a person or 0.2, but obviously you get average, etc. Yeah. So, you know, when you let in, let's say, 5,000 more people, so I'm just going to do some really quick maths and probably get it slightly wrong. But, you know, if you're letting in 5,000 people, 5.4 people, that effectively is looking at about 27,000 people. Multiply it by 2.2 locations. That's 27,000 people extra watching who have gone to 2.2 locations. That comes to about 65,000, what looks like 65,000 extra people on the street. Moving around London. Wow. And that's just by letting in 5,000 people, irrespective of what else is going on in London. And 1,000 people, that's a pretty big football game. That's a pretty big Premiership match. There aren't many stadiums that are fitting more than 65,000 people. So, yeah, there's a huge amount of work that's done by the team on looking at crowd management. You know, our partners, TFL, one of the things I was looking at this year was what was going on the underground. And what's going on DLR? How are the tube stations coping with the number of people? And, you know, we have an amazing, it really is, you know, London coming together, the emergency services, the mayor's office, Transport for London, the boroughs, everyone coming together to try and ensure that people can have the most amazing day and have this amazing community spirit.
Goodness, that really highlights the scope of the London Marathon. My next question was going to be, what's progress for you? Can you talk about that extra 5,000 you let in? Is it just a competition between you and New York over the next 10, 20 years? And are we going to see a London Marathon with 100,000 people in the future? Or is that not possible?
Look, I think firstly, it's not about a competition with New York. You know, you said at the start that New York's where it started. I'd go Boston is where it started. Boston, I call the grandfather of you know, Abbott World Marathon Majors, the World Marathon Majors groups. I think this year, 2026, it's 130th race, 130th year. So it's, you know, yes, you know, New York, you know, in essence, birthed London. And by the way, you can go that the Mumbai Marathon was birthed by London in 2003. So there's a nice theme. Sort of the inspiration that we give each other. So I think really there's a lot of things that we're focused on in terms of there's the mini London Marathon the day before the London Marathon, and this year we had 15,000 school kids taking part. Each child was paid £10 to do the event. So that money went to schools for either sports equipment or computer equipment. And we are targeting the more disadvantaged areas of London, the more disadvantaged schools. So we're giving kids the opportunity to run through that amazing finish line, to be able to see then maybe on telly what they see the next day they will have experienced. And the goal by 2030 is 50,000 school kids taking part the day before. There are some new events that we're going to introduce for 2026. And we do have a plan. We do work very much quite a long way to the future. You know, I'm already planning some of the stuff for 2030, which will be our 50th race. So we sort of, you know, on the day of the event, people ask, well, what do you do? And hopefully it's my least busy day of the year because everything's going absolutely perfectly. But generally, I'm just looking at stuff for the future. You know, you're looking at if you did this or has this worked, and this is what we're planning. So yeah, sometimes I forget almost what year I'm in because my brain is in 26 or 27 or 28 or 2030. So yeah, we've got lots of ideas, and we get ideas off the other races. I speak to the race directors of the World Marathon Majors, which is Chicago, Tokyo, Berlin, Boston, New York, ourselves in Sydney. We speak every 3 weeks on telephone. We have in-person meetings every 6 months, and we really thrive off each other. We're a competitive lot, but it's not about really who can be the biggest. It's just about who can, you know, our purpose as an organization is to inspire activity. And that is inspire activity in all ages and all demographics. And I think what unites us as a company is we passionately believe that activity should be for everyone. We are actually a social purpose organization. Events just happens to be the thing that we tend to do to get people to be active. But it's not just running. We put on a kids' basketball tournament recently. First time that basketball had ever been held in Trafalgar Square. We did it with the NBA in partnerships, junior NBA event, and it was targeting 13 to 15 year old school kids. And in its first pilot year, we got 37% of London secondary schools to enter the event. So yeah, going back to the marathon, we've got lots of plans. I can't say what they are now.
Yeah.
We have to work with the boroughs. It takes time to get that mini London marathon to happen in the way that it is now happening. Took 4.5 years to go through the process of permissions. And, you know, yes, there was COVID in the way, so that definitely slowed things up. But it takes years to plan these huge events because you are affecting London. It is one of the biggest global cities in the world, and you've got to be really careful and considerate to other people, to businesses, to the communities that you're running through, that you're running with in organizing these events.
Oh, I know a lot of kids appreciate that mini marathon. It's the highlight of their year, just like it is for those who run the full 26.2. We do like to focus on the elite end in this podcast, and one of the things I have to ask you is there pressure with the women's elite field to start then with the masses, or will that always, you know, one of the changes perhaps that could be in the future, or will they always be celebrated in their own race, in that women's only race, with records and everything like that being probably pushed at you? Will we see them start with the masses?
No, actually, that's funny enough, that's the first time in 15 years I've been asked that question.
Fair enough.
So no, there's never been any pressure. I mean, to my mind, the more that you can profile women, the more that you can, you know, show parity, then the better that it is. So the fact that they start beforehand, the fact they get their own finish, the fact they're not running with the men, I think is really positive. Don't intend to change it. I mean, nothing, you know, you should never say never, but that is not something that is considered. I can guarantee you that. And I would be pretty vehemently against it, because I don't really, you know, there's plenty of other races where that women can run with men. I think that here it is fantastic that they get the profile, and we have the most amazing women's fields, you know, and it's almost been embarrassing each year for the last five. I think I've said it's been the best women's field ever put together, and it gets more and more embarrassing when you say it, but it's been true every year.
How do you keep doing that? How does London keep attracting the best fields?
So I think look, we have a fantastic head of elite athlete, Spencer Barden. So he's the guy that puts together the fields. I'll sometimes have a conversation with Spencer and go, what about this athlete? And he'll go, oh yeah, they're already signed up. It's like, okay, brilliant. I think there's very few occasions where I've gone, I think we need this athlete. And he's gone, nah, I don't agree. We've generally, you know, he's absolutely on top of his game. And, you know, it is this amazing sort of balancing act that we have to do about getting the greatest athletes, getting enough charity runners, getting enough championship runners, getting enough good for age, getting enough international runners. And how do you balance it? And the reality is no one is ever satisfied with what we've done, which probably is means it's about right. If someone was satisfied, then we've probably given that area too many entries. But yeah, his job is to you know, look to the future. And we do, and we work with the brands, the shoe brands. The fact we have this amazing partnership with the BBC, I think, is one of the standout reasons that for the growth that we've had, the partnership. And we've just signed the deal until 2030. And the fact that it's been on the BBC, it's live broadcast, they do such an amazing job in telling the stories. And it is about storytelling. And yes, we are in an amazing marathon boom at the moment, you know, whether it's the third boom, the fourth boom. I've heard all sorts of different people. I've been through quite a few booms in my time, I can assure you. But, you know, after a boom, there's always a lull. And so I think we have to be, you know, really look to how we can keep inspiring people to go on this journey. And you know, it doesn't always have to be about a marathon. You know, we do events from 1 mile with the Vitality Westminster Mile up to the marathon. And it's just finding the right thing that motivates people at the right time. But going back to the elite fields, yeah, Spencer does an amazing job. Again, we look to the future. We try and look at who's coming through. And they know that London will give them an amazing profile through the incredible relationship that we have with the BBC.
And on the elites, with the news of Ruth Chepngetich getting suspended, obviously she didn't contest London. London is renowned, though, as one of the cleanest, I guess, marathons, or you have the strictest testing protocols at London. How does a headline like, or how does someone like Ruth Chepngetich affect you and Jemima Sumgong, you know, going back a few years as well? How does that affect London?
Yeah, so look, first I have to say that Ruth has the right of appeal. So until that due process has gone through, her suspension is provisional. So I'm going to talk generally about drug taking in athletics. I think, firstly, it is hugely disappointing whenever anybody decides to cheat. That's simply what it is. That, yes, there are pressures on people, and sometimes we don't understand those pressures. You know, whether they're pressures of their family situation, whether they're whatever those societal pressures might be. But what we have to do is do our best to have a clean sport. And actually, London, along with the other world marathon major races, has really worked with World Athletics and most importantly, the AIU, the Athletes Integrity Unit. And we have funded them. We will continue to fund them. And we have worked to ensure that they are funded through other partners as well, to make sure that they can have the best testing process that there is. And I believe that athletics does. It is independent. It is ruthless, rightly so. It is intent on finding cheats. So it is intelligence-led. So it really goes and looks at things in a very, very different way. This is not just about random testing. It's about how do you know where an athlete is? How do you know where they... So there's a whole raft of things that they do. And what we have to do is just ensure that they're properly funded. And that's what we do. So it's enormously disappointing when it happens. We need to keep them properly funded. We need to, you know, what World Marathon Majors do is we don't invite back. We're an invitation series. Yeah. So we don't invite anybody back that has been banned for running. So others, you know, in the sport can't ban an athlete for life, but World Marathon Majors can, because we are an invitation. It is when, you know, they can go and run somewhere else. They can get prize money somewhere else. They're just not going to be invited to our races. So we have to be really strong on that, and we have to properly support the AIU. And just, it is hugely disappointing when someone decides to cheat.
Would you ever think about blacklisting agents, like you blacklist athletes?
I think that the intelligence that this is not an aid, this is not an agent issue, mm-hmm. right? So, and some people are going, oh, well, yeah, agents X, Y, and Z, and there are certain agents they keep mentioning. The intelligence doesn't suggest that, right? It is very, very difficult to, an athlete decides, makes a choice, but actually sometimes maybe they didn't make the choice. Maybe someone made it for them. Maybe someone they trusted gave them something. I think we're very, very quick to judge, and we're very quick to put things into a box that we know and we understand. I think that that's one of the biggest learnings that I've had over the last 30 years just doing business, is whatever you thought often actually isn't the case. Yeah. You just don't know the situation that is going on with that athlete, what pressure has been put on them, whether they knowingly ingested it, whether they didn't, whether someone they trusted gave them something, someone they trusted for years and there's never been a problem. You don't know. So I just think that we have to be rigorous with having an independent body that is doing this testing, that is will go after the athletes, and that they are properly funded.
Do you have a favorite moment of the London Marathon over all the years? A favorite year, maybe?
No, I have a sort of, I think just things that stick in my head was that I last ran the marathon in 2003. And that was 6 weeks after my father had passed away. And I was asked, by the organizers, did I want to run? And I didn't know, and I hadn't done any training. And then I said, yes, I would like to just sort of remember my old man. And I stood on the start line, and there was sort of 30 seconds of applause, and I was there, and Steve Jones was there. And so anyway, I had no idea what I was going to do. All I knew I was going to do was not run 26.2 miles very well. And I didn't know whether I was going to set off a reasonable pace and blow up, or try and start slowly and just gradually get slower and slower and slower, but not explode. Anyway, I decided to run with Steve, and I think he dropped out after about 10K and I carried on. But basically, I did blow up after about 18 miles. But Paula ended up running that incredible time,
of course,
2:15. And John Disley passed away in 2017. And I said to the elite athletes, did a sort of speech to the elite athletes beforehand, and I said that John had recently passed, and that in 2003, 6 weeks beforehand, that my dad had, and then Paul around this incredible time. So now in 2017, it was on them to remember John in a similar way. And Elliot, I think it was 2:02:05 or something, and the world record at the time was something like 2:01:58. I might have got the minutes wrong here, but he was about 7 seconds outside the record, the world record. And it was the day after, and I was on the elevator of the Tower Hotel, and Elliot just came up to me and said, "Oh, I'm really sorry. I didn't break the world record." I mean, just done a course record. He goes, "I didn't actually know I was that close. If I'd known I was that close, I probably could have done it. And I'm just really sorry." And it was like the most sort of, wow, this is one of the greatest touching athletes who's just remembered that conversation, has remembered to say something. And I just think he is the most incredible athlete, and his sort of, how he talks is just as a man, as a human being, his mantra we put on the event, with the operational team for INEOS 159 in Vienna. And we've worked, with Elliot for years, but is just his whole mantra, what he talks about, a hungry man should never chase two rabbits, because then he won't catch either. Just go after one thing and make sure you're going to get that one thing. There are so many things. Mm. So I just think that memory of such a great athlete and such a great human sticks out to me, but there are so many.
Oh, that is the most Elliot story I've ever heard. That's a fantastic place to end. Hugh, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.